Good evening and welcome to the Museum of Modern Art. I'm Glenn Lowry and I'm delighted to see you here for the first of this year's programs, Artists Speak, Conversations on Contemporary Art. I want to thank deeply and with a lot of gratitude the Contemporary Arts Council of the Museum of Modern Art for their generous support of this program. Tonight's discussion is entitled Art and Commerce, Alternative Economies. Two very accomplished artists whom we're especially grateful to have with us this evening, Rikrit Tirvanija and Christine Hill, will make brief presentations that address their work in the context of this theme. Afterwards, the three of us will sit down for a more in-depth conversation about their practice, responding to issues surrounding the relationship between art, economies, and social engagement, and I hope all of you will join us by asking questions. Rikrit, as many of you may know, was born in Buenos Aires in 1961. After high school in Bangkok, Thailand, he studied at the Ontario College of Art in Toronto, the Banff Center of Fine Arts, the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and the Whitney Independent Study Program here in New York. Since 1989, he has traveled widely, creating installations and events in the United States, Europe, Brazil, Japan, Thailand, and has been at biennials in Venice, in New York, Lyon, Guangzhou, and Johannesburg. In 1997, his work was exhibited at the Museum of Modern Art as part of our project series. He is, again, as I'm sure many of you know, the winner of the 2004 Hugo Boss Prize and the Gordon Mata Clark Grant, among many other awards. Since 2001, he has been Associate Professor of Professional Practice at the Faculty of Arts at Columbia University, and he's also taught at the University of Venice, the Royal Danish Art Academy, the Städelschule at the Stylische Hochschule of Bildende Kunst in Frankfurt, and the National Academy of Fine Arts in Oslo. Christine Hill was born in Binghamton, New York in 1968. She received her Bachelor of Fine Arts from the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore in 1991. From 1991 to 1999, she lived in Berlin, where she continues to live today. Her work has been exhibited internationally, including the 2007 Venice Biennial and Documenta 10. And she has collaborated on numerous projects with recording studios, printing presses, improv groups, and public art institutions. Among other honors, Christine has been the recipient of the Berlin Pool Fellowship Award in 1996 and had an artist residency at PS1 Contemporary Art Center here in New York. She is professor and chair of media, trend, and public appearance at the Bauhaus University in Weimar, and her students oversee a number of the Volksboutique organizational ventures from the workshop there. We'll hear a lot more about that, I'm sure. So please welcome first Christine and then Rikrit.
Guten Abend. I hope you can all hear me. It would be a really absurdist twist to do this entire thing in German, wouldn't it? Yes, but I will not. And I will apologize that I'm a tiny bit attacked by the thing that is attacking many of us, and my voice is a little bit raspy. But I hope you will persevere with me. I've also brought two tissues up here with me in case I need them. I am going to talk about my project Volksboutique, which I think very nicely will fit into the theme of art and commerce and alternate economies. Perhaps after seeing these images and hearing me talk about it, you will be able to decide for yourselves if that is indeed the case or if it is not the case. As Glenn briefly explained, I moved to Berlin in 1991, weeks after my graduation from the Maryland Institute, and I've mostly based my practice there since. Volksboutique is the name of my studio. It is coined after the GDR, socialist terminology, Volkseigenen Betrieb, which loosely describes a kind of system of collective ownership that was running in the GDR prior to the reunification of Germany. I will also say that 15 minutes is an incredible challenge for me to talk about this work. I am incredibly wordy, and if you spend your life living in Germany, you are very wordy because the words are very long in German. So this is kind of a new attempt for me to show you my work in 15 minutes and 18 slides. I have therefore opted to economize and put multiple images on individual pages, which is a new trick for me. So you're looking at a couple of pictures of the Volksboutique, which was a secondhand store that I opened in Berlin in 1996. I had been living in Berlin the entire time for 5 years prior. Most of my work up to that point was consisting of a series of service occupations that I was doing to simultaneously earn my living, and was occasionally being invited to show as art installations in a lot of group exhibitions in Europe. Simultaneously to living, to doing all of that, I was touring in a rock band for 3 years throughout most of Europe, and so the extreme movement of that period was making me sort of long to kind of get off the road and house myself more permanently in Berlin. And so the Volksboutique was sort of my invention to provide myself both a means of autonomy, have a place where instead of my exporting myself all the time to places that were interested in seeing my work, that I would try to kind of turn the traffic around and have actually people come into this space that I had created. It also continued to solve the dilemma of making something that was about my life and making something that could support me and simultaneously be something I considered an artistic practice. So the Volksboutique was located in Berlin-Mitte for a year. Literally after I had opened the doors, it was visited by the curatorial team of Documenta 10, who then included it in their presentation in Kassel in 1997. For that exhibition, I sort of franchised the store and opened up another store in Kassel during the duration of this exhibition. And this sort of magnified the visitors to this to the store both in Berlin and Kassel significantly. Quite a lot of people attend Documenta in the 100 days that it runs, and so I was sort of dealing with customers on a much more kind of exploded scale. But it was actually the reception of Volksboutique at Documenta and simultaneously in Berlin and just the amount of conversations I had with people visiting the store that made me start to consider, you know, thoughts about artistic jobs, what the skill is that an artist is actually offering to the public that receives the work, what happens when someone sets up a space that a lot of conversations can happen in, and what happens with that information and what happens with that sort of energy that is created. I do think a lot about artistic labor, what comprises it, how it's paid for. Kind of anecdotally, being in an exhibition like Documenta, a lot of discussions with people about, you know, basically also kind of wondering, like, well, where are the price tags, or you know, why did we pay 25 marks to get in here, or how come the books are for sale when they should be free, and, you know, just numerous conversations about what they expect and how things are set up. This led me to sort of reform Volksboutique less as, kind of close the idea that it was a store and sort of open it up to this idea of being a kind of production format. Although I still kind of consider all of the things that Volksboutique does to be a kind of way of keeping shop or keeping the shop open. The previous slide was of a piece I did in New York called Tour Guide, which in 1999 during my PS1 residency, I was invited by Public Art Fund to, let's go back to that. This thing goes both ways. It also does this. let's look at this. Okay. Tour guide was actually the second kind of large-scale fausse boutique adventure that I decided to take myself on and other people, and it was, in effect, a fully functioning tour guide agency running out of Soho for a period of 3.5 months. And there's literally last week, a magazine published something about projects of mine and prefaced tour guide with being a fictional tour guide agency in Soho, where I really thought, you know, what am I going to have to do to explain to these people that I'm actually trying out these jobs, doing them, and then moving onwards with them? There would have been no sense to me to open a tour guide agency and not take people anywhere or to pretend to do something. So this is, you'll see from the imagery, things that are repeating in these projects. Quite a lot of sitting behind desks. I've never had a desk job, but I'm sort of perpetually fascinated by what happens at desks and cubicle culture and what it is people get done if they're trying to look like they're getting something done or if they are actually getting something done. The TV talk show format, specifically the Conan O'Brien show, made me think about why is it that the talk show hosts are always behind a desk at night? It's midnight, they're wearing a suit, and work is being simulated. You know, they are working. And I also like this idea of television talk shows where their job is to kind of milk a conversation and get something out of it that is entertainment or that is that seems meaty, even, you know, regardless of whether they're interviewing a politician or if they're interviewing, you know, kind of a C-list model who nobody's heard of. And so that also got me to explore that format as part of Fausse Boutique. And so these are a series of systems that I refer to as organizational ventures, partially because I react quite skeptically to the term performance art, not historically, but I think that today when we hear the word performance art, I think people's minds leap very quickly to people on fire or theatrics, and these are sort of cliches of that terminology, but I really kind of felt like if I was going to create my own term to describe what it is what I was doing, that would be a little bit more accurate than people saying, well, it's supposed to be this or it's supposed to be that. It's installation art, but she's in it, and it's a performance, but she's not playing something. It's actually something quite real and something that's actually being genuinely executed. So the organizational ventures that I do, depending on how, what kind of system I have available to me to set them up, enables me to kind of take on an occupation and really explore it to a degree that I feel that I've informed myself and informed a visiting public about. And I will say that what it also means is that in exhibition context, that I am performing all of this work in front of whoever is visiting the exhibition. So people come in and they think maybe it's theater or something is being, performed as not a real thing, but actually in the case of producing a television talk show, for example, people were coming in and seeing writing meetings, people on the phone, things that they actually recognize from their own work culture, from their own lives, and they were just seeing it kind of twisted into a form that nothing is being done particularly theatrically or ingenuously, but it's all being done to show people, like, just, you know, shift your frame of perspective for a minute and see what it is that is all around us and how it becomes kind of an artistic medium. I thought I would add that, as you've probably already seen from some of the imagery, I'm quite interested in the kind of ephemeral product that most of these projects produce. And here's a little excerpt of some of the design elements of Fausse Boutique. Because I regard myself as more of a kind of small business owner than an artist necessarily, I started filling up the small business with some accoutrements that belong to a small business, whether it's business cards or its own reference library, kind of swag that the label actually in the bottom corner that keeps reappearing is what's called an anniversary sticker that car manufacturers use when they have a milestone, and Fausse Boutique turned 10 in 2006, so I had a suite of stickers made. I'm kind of, oh, what is the next slide? Oh, it's this. So you can see in some of these images as well, Volkspartik pencils, a kind of ubiquitous tip jar in German there in the middle. The earlier pieces that I was doing prior to opening the Volkspartik, I would largely perform a task that I was apprenticing, being a masseuse in Berlin, and then export those tasks to exhibitions that I was invited to, and do this largely on a tip jar basis only. This was actually quite effective because being quite young artists in the 90s and having kind of the excitement of going to all these group exhibitions, they don't really pay anything. And so it was very exciting to go, but then everybody's there. And I remember being in one exhibition with a number of amazing artists, you know, who were all at very kind of, you know, early stages of their career, and everyone kind of grousing about, like, wow, you know, everyone was kind of mutually broke and mutually kind of like, we didn't know where to get a sandwich in the place that we were at, and they hadn't provided us anything. And one of the artists made the mistake of saying, I'm never doing something like this for $4,000 again. And there was this collective gasp where we all looked at him and said, like, you got $4,000? And it was this very uncomfortable moment for everyone involved. Or, you know, the ones that didn't have the $4,000 were all like, note to self, next time, send a bill. So, of course, for me, the way of circumnavigating that was to just say, whoa, tip jar, okay, everything's clear. Like, I'm not going to charge you to partake of my my wares, but I am going to give you the opportunity to reward me for my industriousness at your own discretion. One of the, despite a lot of these projects happening in the exhibition sites that host them, I do keep a studio, which I call the Volkspartik Products Division. I initially started making a lot of work that was really just about rearranging existing material, I'm not particularly interested in art, in objects that have to be made by the artistic hand, but I do sort of realize that I am forever surrounded by collections of things that I have amassed, and that the products division became the sort of zone where I could kind of take inventory of them all, collect them, dust them, label them, and then ship them out. So you're seeing also a piece that is called the Care Package, which is a series of works where I do sort of pick a theme. A person is allowed to access the package, which basically means they acquire a sort of empty box that has a series of tiers in it and little places for objects. This is kind of inspired by like a cheese platter that you can order at Christmas time cheese starts coming, you know, once a month or something. And so the idea was that a collector could buy the care package with a theme. The one that's in this photograph is sustainability. And then every month something arrives, and they don't know what's going to be coming. There will be some kind of explanation of why this object represents sustainability, and they decide where it goes in this care package. And then at the end of the subscription period, the package is full, and the artwork is therefore complete. I also thought I would show this in talking about collecting information. This was a commission by Creative Time in New York City, where they're specifically interested in talking about Times Square. And I had been thinking about how much it must cost to light Times Square, or, you know, what does it cost for the Coca-Cola sign to light itself, or Pepsi-Cola, or what does any individual piece of advertising in Times Square cost? And not surprisingly, it is very, 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 very difficult to ring up any of these corporations and say, how much are you paying for your ad space on Times Square? And so what I decided to do is instead address the topic of that by making a little informational wheel. The kind of most important piece of information on this wheel actually is to the slight left of the T, which says impressions per day, which according to advertising research, any single thing that is in Times Square at any given moment is getting the exact same number of impressions, which an impression is lingo for how many eyes land on that advertising. So according to these statistics, the hugest piece of lit advertising in Times Square, and myself writing Folks Boutique Rocks on a bus state, you know, on the bus seat, they will get the exact same amount of visual attention from any viewers. And so that is the purpose. I'm very quite interested now, the occupation that I find that Folks Boutique is kind of moving towards now is that of a sort of hobby archivist or hobby librarian. And so now I've started like kind of embarking on doing these sort of inventories of any given information, whether it be kind of inventorying what the information around Times Square is. This is a project in Berlin called Welt der Weisheit, which means World of Wisdom, which is a kind of ongoing project of talking to a lot of small business owners about their day-to-day business lives. And you also see running through this whole presentation, I have a particular penchant for kind of the slightly cheesy aphorism or slogan that is either you know, corporate slogans, especially in Germany, the kind of like up with people aphorism is very popular. So a lot of these are kind of punctuating these works. Welt der Weisheit is a kind of location system for all of these small business owners. It's almost like, you know, Zagat when they go through the restaurants and they pick the ones, they give everyone a sticker. And so traditionally there will be the sticker that says Zagat Survey 2006, kind of like we're in, we're members. And so the idea here is also that a lot of these stores, after sort of us conducting something together, a kind of Q&A about how business is going, they get a sticker and they're sort of brought into the club. This is also the top image is of Joseph Meyer Stationer, which is a former stationery store in Lower New York, and I was quite a rabid client of this store, and subsequently, I would say probably about 95% of that store's inventory is now in my possession after his closing. I'm quite interested in just discussing business practice with people who own small businesses, especially in this climate. Less so in Germany is the sort of Walmartization of shopping culture happening, but it is of course happening there too. So I actually like to surround myself with memories that there are actually all of these people who kind of got into business for other reasons than, you know, whatever the bottom line is, or that they've also decided that there is a very specific way to populate or arrange the way they conduct their business and the way it visually also appears. So a lot of this is a sort of bumpy segue. A lot of the collections I keep end up in sort of reliquary objects, and here is a few of them. The one on the left is part of a trunk show that has been shown as a set. This is a series of trunks. This is a collaboration between myself and the artist, but also kind of master bookmaker, Mark Wagner. And we kind of conceived these trunks, also thinking about librarianism, as sort of exploded books, a kind of overly dimensional books. And these trunks are also quite sizable, patterned after steamer trunks. And they hold actually the complete accoutrement for performing any given number of work tasks. There are five total right now, and they sort of are broken down into the five-day work week. So you have like, if I, as the proprietor of Folks Boutique, am kind of wearing all the hats in any given week, I am the accountant, the manager, the producer, the PR person, and the, what's the last one? I'm drawing a blank. Management, perhaps. And so the idea was that since I'm wearing all these hats, I can kind of keep all of my jobs kind of in a portable situation. The bottom right-hand kit, also made by Mark Wagner, is I call it the stamp kit. It's kind of a portable publishing system. A few slides earlier, you saw perhaps, if you were paying attention, which I hope you were, this stamp kit kind of in action. If I get invited to do things that don't have any kind of really duration, you know, performance festivals I get invited to often, I usually bring the stamp kit and sort of make posters. I like this whole, like, your name on a grain of rice, or the guys in Soho who are making your name in like butterfly lettering. I really love those type of solutions. So I kind of invented my own. This is also a library project. This is called the Accounting Archive, and this is also ongoing. This is just a huge collection of people writing down personal anecdotes into a system of ledgers, and then these anecdotes, they're a ledger system that's about this large, and then they're bound into books and then available as a small library for reading, not for purchase. This is also, for me, a very interesting project because it sort of expands to me on the idea of a guest book. Every museum or a lot of gallery exhibitions have a guest book, and usually the guest books have people saying very nice show, or the lighting was too dark, or some sort of graffiti, or, you know, Kilroy was here, or these kind of predictable, you know, civic expression. But I actually was completely surprised by the as this project tours that people have written some incredibly, incredibly moving and incredibly frank details into these ledgers, which is completely impressive to me and completely inspiring. And so I like to have been able to create something that can kind of catalog those kind of experiences. And so I thought, in an exhibition context, this is some of what the exhibitions look like. So I think at this point it's kind of clear that there's a very, initially the Folk's Boutique, because it was coming out of the kind of the ruins of the GDR, was, you know, very East German looking. A lot of the things that I had in the Folk's Boutique were cast-offs from the GDR culture. When I moved to Berlin in 91 and 92, people were literally throwing their things out of their apartments, fully functional washing machines, typewriters, every single thing for their daily lives, and they were immediately upgrading to West German products. Whether or not that is an upgrade, I find debatable. But so the city was just overrun with piles and piles and piles of people's daily life cast-offs, and I was frantically running around with a wagon collecting them all and bringing them back to my space. And that somehow did morph into a more I actually personally don't find it a nostalgic way of presenting my work visually, but I do actually like to talk about I personally am very moved by some of the pictures you've seen of the shop, other people's shop installations is a visual language that I respond to personally very seriously, and so I'm always trying to, of course, recreate it in my own installations. So you're seeing here on the top, the top two images are part of a Folk's Boutique retrospective of organizational ventures that happened in 2002 and 2003, and that is subsequently discussed in the book Inventory. And the bottom left is the Venice Biennial, the trunk show in display in 2007, and the bottom right is an exhibition in Ronald Feldman Fine Arts in New York. The kind of penchant for collecting, my interest, I have also living in Germany, language is quite important to me. What words mean different things, etymology is quite important for me also in the German language specifically. And that got me thinking about a whole new series of projects. This is quite recent. This is from the beginning of this year. This project is called Revolution Flea Market, and it was birthed out of a conversation about the iPod being revolutionary and how words like revolution or genius get sort of thrown out there, and we're all supposed to understand what it is that they mean, and we use them far too frequently, even though actual revolutionary action or actual genius behavior isn't as rampant or isn't, unfortunately, as frequent as language might described to us. And so this collection, it's on a kind of handcrafted vendor's cart. This is a collection of what you get when you try to buy revolution primarily on the internet. And so I spent a concise period of time actively buying everything that was calling itself revolution. There's revolution vodka, there's revolution tea, there is lots of things with Che on them, lots and lots and lots of things with Che on them, a lot of books. Scarily, there's the company that owns Revolution Tea has registered international worldwide patents for every single food drugstore item that could be potentially called revolution. When you look up a patent, you get these huge lists that toothbrushes, flour, sugar, tea, coffee, toilet paper, every single thing that you could possibly buy in a drugstore or in a grocery store, they have named revolution, which I assume means soon there's going to be a revolution. There's going to be like a drugstore, and instead of being called Walgreens, it's going to be called Revolution, which is perverse. And so the idea was, of course, to make some sort of incredibly absurd object collection that kind of tries to house all of these bizarre products that have been purchased for Revolution. And I kind of feel like I'm very open now to it, terms that you feel might deserve their own collection. I'm sure typing in, I don't know, nostalgia or something into the internet and seeing what the internet tells us it is might be a compelling project. You can do it yourselves. And we can all have a Flickr website and we will put them all together. So I believe I've completely lost track of how long I've been talking. I've tried to keep it short and concise and at the same time do give some description to what it is that I'm doing. So if you have questions later, I will be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for being here. Thank you for having me here, Glenn. Well, Christine's presentation is completely the opposite of mine, as you will see and find out. It's all purely amateur photography and things kind of blurry and unfocused. So Joe Plummer is worried about about the redistribution of his wealth, right? And I have to say, I'm not. I'm very happy to redistribute anything or whatever it is that I have. And so in a way, I think that's one of my starting point in this relationship to the idea of economy or having one at all. I think the other condition I think I felt as a young, at least young artist, was that I wanted to be an artist so that I didn't have to work. Which, you know, may be a wrong kind of assumption as a young person, but that was kind of my goal. And you know, after having been here for all this time, I realized actually I've worked very hard to not work. But it is always about that kind of idea of, like, the relationship between, you know, what really is relevant to how you exist, right? And I would say for me, to kind of live and exist in some kind of, with some kind of idea of alternative structure or this idea of being alternative was to, of course, kind of always be in a position of being completely destabilized and always being improvisational in a way. So I think I've, like, you know, just walked up here and didn't prepare anything at all or any thoughts to what I was going to say tonight. That's part of it. I think one of the things that's important for me was that I do come from a culture which is very much living in a very kind of communal and very, as I say, you know, very distributed in terms of, like, the relationship to some kind of economy or some kind of object or you know, relationship to structures. And so I think part of that is very, very kind of, is always being in the background in terms of, like, how I operate and think and work and you know, live. This is a work, and I don't remember anymore what year or when anything is done, so we'll just talk about the work directly. It's an apartment that was reconstructed in the museum Kunstverein in Cologne. I think it was probably 1997 or 96. And I'd been given a prize to go and live in Cologne for 6 months. It was the first time they've given out the prize. And as I arrived to Cologne, you know, the curator who was in charge of the whole situation was taking me in the car and said, "Well, we have nothing here. There's nothing. You have to start everything from scratch, you know. So we have a little bit of money for you to, you know, buy all the things you need for your house and move in." And as we were driving to IKEA, I was thinking to myself, well, you know, if I'm going to have to buy all these things and you know, spend money on these things, which I'm going to be using for the next 6 months, I should try to find a way of making use of these things, not to waste the money. And as those thoughts were going through my head, I realized perhaps I should reconstruct this little apartment that I was living in New York. And then at the end of the 6 months, which is when exactly the exhibition would occur, I would just put all the things that I bought and put it into the apartment. And that would justify me buying, you know, whatever it was that I was going to buy, and that it would continue to be used in a way as part of the exhibition or as the work. And of course, I've been working with the idea of living and cooking and kind of interaction and relational structures. So the idea of having an apartment as a kind of as a platform, really, for a lot of things that could happen in this relationship was, I think for me it was kind of like very, in a way, had all the kind of conditions which I felt would be necessary for what I was interested in. So in the apartment there was a kitchen, there was a bathroom, and everything was fully functioning. And I think another very interesting part, I think, of that was that the idea of time and the idea of duration, which is also, I think, quite important when you start to discuss the idea of economy. And I requested that they kept the space open 24 hours a day for 7 days a week, which, of course, was my idea that if you were going to have an apartment which was going to be fully functioning, that it should, of course, be used as if it was an apartment, and an apartment is always, in a sense, you know, always working. We were in Germany, so we had to stop for one day, which was basically Sunday between 6 and 10 the next day. So there was basically, you know, 6.5 days of continuous operation. And the apartment was basically left, and people came in and used it in many different ways, in a very kind of communal way, because a lot of people somehow kind of heard about it and came continuously to spend time with it. These photographs you see are actually made by the people who came, so there was a kind of instant, you know, disposable camera that was left there, and people just took pictures themselves. And I actually was away, since as soon as the exhibition went up, I left. And so these are the only things I've seen from. I'd never really experienced, you know, all these people being in the space ever. It was quite unexpected in a way, but on the other hand, I think partly because it was a kind of prize, and it was, I think, situated at a point where there was a kind of a lot of events going around Cologne. A lot of young students came, and of course they couldn't afford to stay in hotels and whatnot, so they all came and stayed, and you know, with their sleeping bags. And it was up for like 3 months, so people came and had their weddings, you know. Children came and had their birthday parties. There was a lot of space around the whole, you know, structure itself. So artists came and put on exhibitions and made performances. And this was all going on. I mean, you know, I actually never really witnessed any of it, but I've heard stories about it. And So that was the kind of very important stage in terms of how my work in a way shifted from a kind of more or less a small structural activity in a kind of contained amount of time to something a lot more open. I'm going to kind of just flash through some slides, and at the same time, or at this moment anyway in time, I've kind of come to a point where, you know, I again say I could stop doing things, but of course you never do. And I start to move back to Thailand just as a way to try to slow things down and to get a bit of distance and, you know, to make it harder for people to call me up on the phone. And so as I moved back to Thailand, I realized that there was a lot of things to do actually in Thailand, being that, you know, it's a place where culturally or in terms of in the relationship to the arts, there has not been a lot of institutional or structural conditions which were kind of, you know, supporting the idea of the arts. We have a lot of artists and a lot of very interesting artists, but we don't have, for example, a real museum, or actually up till maybe perhaps like 3 years ago, we didn't really have a real kind of, even the kind of gallery support system that we could really, you know, fully, you know, acknowledge as something that was supporting the artists. And so when I went back, I thought that I would try to kind of, you know, be to kind of shift the work into, instead of like being an artist, but to shift the work towards being kind of more of a support system. This is a group of people in Oslo, Norway, and it's just kind of leading up to this part of the work that I've been working on with a lot of other people in Bangkok and also in Chiang Mai. Where I'm here in Oslo to basically work with a group of students, and I don't have all the pictures of the whole thing, so we're just a lot of people sitting around talking. But basically we have come together to organize a magazine, or to kind of gather together to kind of try to produce a magazine, which was already started in Bangkok before I came to Oslo. And this is just one of the idea of the stations of the magazine. So I would arrive into Oslo and proposing to make a station for the magazine, and then everyone would come around and then we would discuss about the possibility of what could go into the magazine. So the magazine was a kind of platform for information or for ideas or for discussions, and that was in a way quite open in terms of the structure, what it would be. It was always based on the input of and the interest of the people who would basically present things within this kind of platform. Here's another situation again in Frankfurt at the Porticus. It's an exhibition at the Porticus just before the Porticus moved out of its original space. I think it's one of the last two or three exhibitions. And I've just built this kind of floor and ceiling into the space with onto an existing exhibition by Elmgren and Druckset, who had built this kind of wave into the building. And when Mikkel and Inga's exhibition was over, they would have to, of course, dismantle all this bubble or this kind of construction in the space. And I just called them up and I said, well, it would just be better if I just built these platforms onto your work, and if that would be okay. And of course, they were fine about it. So we used it almost like as a diving board. And on this particular platform itself, a lot of different kinds of events occurred. with people in Cologne. One of the evenings, every Thursday evening, there would be a kind of cooking battle, which was organized by, you know, local artists and curator. Here's Kasper Koenig cooking a soup against Thomas Beile, another artist. And everyone would show up and, of course, partake in the cooking and seemingly supposed to be evaluating who would be the better cook, but we never really got that far. Here's a young artist who was basically the kiosk of the exhibition, and he would basically trade, you know, whatever people needed. So he would have a stall, a kind of kiosk with drinks and liquor and condoms and, you know, everything, chocolate, whatever. And whenever you would come up to him, he would say, well, what do you have, you know, that could be interesting? And what you see behind him is all the things that people gave him in exchange for the, you know, the kind of the objects that he was kind of basically selling. This is the magazine, and it's called Ver, but in a way it's actually coming from the word over, and the O is just dropped off to the side, and comes from a Thai youth slang, which is basically coming from an English word, but they would use it to describe, you know, the condition where people were just kind of off the edge, like had fallen off the edge. And it was, again, kind of used as a platform rather than as a real magazine. All the contents of the magazines were basically, instead of textual, was all audible. So people would send a track, a voice track, or an interview, or a sound, or, you know, whatever that was kind of can be recorded as a content. And then along with that, they would send an image that would then be put into the printed material. So in the middle, inserted into the middle of the magazine, was always these kind of CD discs that you could then listen to. And everything was always in the original sound, meaning, you know, so people from China would send in a story about chrysanthemum tea. You would just hear people speaking in Chinese about it. Or in this case, an artist, Matthew Antezzo, and a kind of alternative, I think, techno group from Frankfurt. So there would be music and some kind of other sounds to go along with it. And at the moment, there slowly is an issue that's, so it's kind of continuously going. And when we first started off, we said, well, we would just, you know, do it whenever we have the money for it, or whenever we have the material for it. So when people, so continuously people would send in material and sound and images to this office in Bangkok, and whenever there was a certain amount enough to publish, or whenever we had enough money to print and make the CDs, we would publish issue. So it was a magazine that didn't really have any kind of particular time or date or schedule. And I think at this point we haven't made one in 4 years, so... But it's somehow continuing to be made. There's a station in New Zealand in the last month, so there are people in New Zealand at the moment kind of putting all the things together. Because of that situation of, you know, working and providing a kind of, say, an office to basically be a support structure for other activities, and the activities at this point can be the magazine, or we've also started a kind of a small exhibition space within the office itself. And then you'll see later the land, which is up in the north of Thailand, as something to kind of, because as an artist, I'm a terrible person to speak to other people about money. So I found some other structure to raise money for the things we needed to do for the office, to have the office or to have people run the space or come in and put things together. I've started to make works which I would say is a continuation of my interests, but at the same time they're kind of parallel structures to other things I do. It's actually, there's an exhibition at the drawing center up at the moment of these demonstration drawings, and here are some actually young Korean student artists who've been given the drawings or given the images to draw for an exhibition. But what happens is that I would basically collect these images and I would send them back to the office in Bangkok, and the office would find some young artists who needed to supplement their income by making these drawings. And then the drawings would, of course, then be shown and at some point sold. And from the sales, the money would then go back to the office or to other kind of activities which are not necessarily, which are basically being funded through the drawings themselves. This is the land, which is up in Chiang Mai, and it's been there for now, I think, 10 years. And originally, it was started off as a kind of retirement space, just a place to be, for artists to go and retire. And it was a discussion between a lot of different artist friends about the idea of, like, stopping and trying to kind of have a space to maybe think and or to actually have a kind of slower speed in relationship to like everything else that's going on around between us. And I went back to Thailand and I have a friend who was living there who was also working on a very similar idea with local Thai artists. And so we kind of came together and basically purchased this small piece of land, realizing in a way on my part that we were trying to do things in the West, in France, and it was quite difficult, economically, because everything cost a lot more, and at the same time bureaucratically, because everything had to be clear and, precise and put down on paper. Whereas in Thailand, there was kind of a blur. There's a kind of gap between the idea of, actually how one could exist. So we could just purchase the land and go on it and start to build and make activities and to basically do whatever we want, really, without, in a way, having to kind of go to the authorities and get permission or to, kind of deal with all the other bureaucratic things that one would normally have to when one would, kind of start to live on a piece of land. In the same moment, we also realized that for us to be outside of that structure, we would have to, of course, kind of keep ourselves relatively self-contained and self-sustaining. So a couple of the main things we have been, we started off with was to completely stay off the grid, which is to not have any electricity or water. And that's been kind of one of the kind of, main conditions that we have to work around and try to find our ways around when we are out on this piece of land. It's of course it's a part of a farming, rural farming area. So one of the main kind of basic thing for us to use it was of course to actually use it as a farm, and so there are two plots of rice that we grow in the middle of this property, and everyone or people who are interested would come out, and it's not every day that people would get an experience to basically grow out and plant, you know, plant rice and grow vegetables and things like that. And then, of course, at the end of it, to harvest it all and then to basically take it home. So it was a kind of, even for young Thai people who, you know, grew up pretty much in this area, it was kind of completely something as a kind of an education to, you know, be out there and actually work. And within that relationship, we, of course, work with the neighbors who are basically farmers who knows exactly what to do and are able to show us certain things. Most of the farming area, of course, are now kind of operating in a way with, you know, using chemicals and fertilizers and insecticides and things like that. So that's something that we've kind of try to basically avoid. So we've kind of come into this place and isolated the area itself so that we wouldn't have to, or at least we would just like let things grow without having to do all the normal things that everyone thinks they should be doing. But at the same time, it's been much more productive not to use fertilizers and to use pesticides on our plot, and that in a way has also become an issue for people around us who suddenly realized that, you know, they didn't need to do what they were always doing, which they were not doing before, but they were somehow sold on it. So it's kind of in a way kind of like rethinking again the situation which everyone else was existing in. Again, the land itself doesn't have any funding, or we've never raised money, and it's really purely been paid off by myself and my partner, just from like whatever work we've, you know, made, and specifically kind of somehow allotted to kind of fund this place itself. And until up until recently, now we've been given some money through the Ministry of Contemporary Arts in Thailand, which is a completely new department in the Ministry of Education. So for the first time in Thailand, you know, we've finally have a kind of department which is actually dealing with funding the contemporary arts, or actually any kind of art at all. Most of the art funding that has been in existence was always for antiquities, which directly relates, you know, goes from, you know, the idea of tourism. So it's a very new thing that there is a new little office that's actually funding contemporary art or art at all. And most of the people you see on the field here are young artists, and a lot of them graduated from the university in Chiang Mai. And after graduating, of course, there is really no place else to go, you know, or in terms of like what one would do with oneself as an artist. And I think the land has been set up as a kind of platform for these young people also to have kind of space to continue in some ways with their interests, or in what they're interested in, which is to continue to be an artist, but also at the same time also to offer them also alternative structures within that idea of how one would be an artist. So the idea of, like, you know, an artist being able to grow your own rice is a kind of condition I think we're being interested in as part of the discussion. We've created a residency program also for young artists and writers and actually anybody in any field who would be interested to come and stay at the land. And my partner, Kamin, had initiated it 3 years ago, and the group that you see in this photograph was a part of that residency. So everyone would come and live together and work together as a kind of communal structure as part of the land. And then on their own, they would work on their whatever interests they have. We've just kind of now coming out of a second cycle of residency, which will end, I think, in November. And from the beginning, we've started to realize that the just kind of to have people come and live and work and do whatever they needed to do was not enough. And so now we've kind of started to have a kind of more structural program in relationship to, like, the residency. And a lot of the people who were in the first year of the one-year program have basically been running the second-year program. Of course, in this kind of situation, you know, after whatever working and cooking and eating, everyone would be sitting around and trying to figure out what it is that everyone's doing there and what the possibilities are of moving forward. We also do exhibitions at the land itself, though we've never really planned for the land to be any kind of art-related center or a sculptural park, or, you know, we've kind of always refused that kind of idea. But of course, you know, in the soft part of things, you know, art is always being discussed and always a kind of part of the dialogue. And I think one of the very important questions has always been, like, is the land, you know, actually art or not? Or, you know, are we actually making a kind of condition of art there? And this is a kind of ongoing argument. I myself tend not to even ask the question and just kind of move on. So, and I think that's about it. This is a poster. Well, this is actually a poster that was put up around Saraja, which was in the Arab Emirates and was part of the Saraja Biennial. Initially, I'd asked them to make these kind of road signs, these blinking lights with the arrow saying "Less oil, more courage," with an arrow towards, you know, the exhibition from Dubai. And of course, they couldn't do that, so they actually made a poster and stuck them up around town instead. And yeah, so I think we'll just kind of get on the stage and go on from there. Thank you. I forgot. I was going to say someone should stand up when it's 15 minutes.
Don't leave now. It's getting exciting. Come on.
Well, thank you very much, Christine and Rikrit. You know, I'm really struck by, on the one hand, you know, some very different approaches that you have, but at the same time, some real similarities, Joe Plummer aside. We have to give Joe Plummer his due, especially
yes.
As we head into these last days of the election. But I'm really interested, actually, in the way you think about your audience. So with the Folks Boutique, who is your audience, and what is the relationship that you're trying to develop with that audience, or does the audience even matter? And I'd ask the same for you, Rickard. How do you imagine an audience, and what are you seeking to establish in relationship to an audience? Or again, does it matter, Christine?
I assume it was clear, but I didn't explain the etymology of false boutique. That loosely translates to being kind of the boutique of the people. Or a place where people make the actual work. And the word folk in German is quite charged term to be using. Initially I was trying to assimilate into Germany, and so I felt like the audience was basically any sense of audience was basically anyone I was interacting with, and my attempt to sort of come over to to whatever level they are. And with the opening of the shop, it was to see who's coming into the, who is going to come in. And it was a very kind of broad mixture of students, people interested in secondhand clothing, and actually less, art interested people than I might have imagined initially. And when it went to Documenta in Kassel, I said, all of a sudden, instead of a normal day in Berlin where 35 people would come by, all of a sudden, a normal day was 5,000 people, nose to the glass, kind of staring into the shop. And it completely changed the dynamic of how it worked. But what remained was, a lot of people, when people go to Documenta, it's way beyond just art interested people. I assume they're interested in art, but it's not people who are having an active daily dialogue about the art system. And so conversing with them about what their expectations were from art, or even noting, people would kind of come into the shop and kind of throw themselves down and be like, and just be sort of relieved to, either relieved for a place to sit down or relieved for something they felt they got, at the same time being a little bit skeptical of, this looks like something we already know, so why is it being framed to us as an art project? And I don't know if I'm even answering the question about it, but I really felt like there's got to be a broad number of people who you can discuss things about how you live your life with. And, because we all have that tool, we all have a life, and we're all living it. So, telling people that actually living that life in a very conscious way is an art tool.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think audience is a kind of problem.
You're in a museum, after all.
Well, we're not Van Gogh, so. I think that for me, it's a problem which is an interesting problem, because I think I'm kind of used as an example of somebody who tries to maybe, open things up and try to relate to a lot of people. And I think it's kind of difficult. And so I think for me, going back to Thailand is a way of kind of, trying to deal with a completely different kind of structure, which is to say, not to think about art, but to find some other form in a way. So the idea of a magazine which is sold in the bookshop down the street would be, a way of dealing with that question of the audience. But of course, you it's very different than an audience that you're, connected to or touch, or have a touch with or by. I think it's for me, it's a matter of layers of how one works. The idea of working in a rice field and then, having the neighbors come in is another condition of an audience. We're as much their audience as they are ours. So, it's a different way of, I think, thinking. Being in the kind of frame of art and the art world, in a way, is another kind of audience. And I think
for me, it's I tend to try to think that it's possible to operate with different layers and different ideas of how one approach that idea. So I rather approach different ideas of audience in very different ways. You know, to put a poster up in the street or to make T-shirts for the Gap is a very different thing than to build an apartment inside, art museum. I think the Kunstverein, and I think for me, I mean, you know, the relationship to time and the aspect of how long things are working is very much about trying to find a way to extend a condition for a greater audience, you know. But museums always have a problem with that. They can't stay open 24 hours a day. They can't let people walk over everything. And, so I think you can do certain things inside and you have to do certain things outside as well. I mean, that's at least my interest anyway.
Feel free to talk to each other as well. I'll pose some questions and we'll let the audience, everyone out here, ask as well. But let me flip it around. I mean, if there's one side of an equation, are all of us who get to experience the situations you create. The other side of this, I think, is you. And the sense, it seems to me that both of you are involved in a kind of very generous act of doing something that requires a tremendous amount of, maybe it's not work, but effort on your part to bring us together in an unusual and unexpected way. And I'm interested in how, you know, is that an accurate way of thinking about what you're doing? You mentioned assimilate. So clearly you want to be part of another culture, part of something different.
I went to an art school, and I think it was clear to me that that was going to be my vocation, but I think when I was in high school, you know, they put you through some test to, like, gauge your aptitude, and then they say, you can be a journalist or you will be a doctor or something, and they always give you a very skinny, I don't know, it was always very kind of like a handful of, you know, you'd be a good lawyer, you'd be a good this, you'd be good that, and when I spent some time at a university before going to an art school, and I was flabbergasted at some of the very specific kind of majors people or minors people had, and I had no idea where they'd found out about all of these different things you could pursue. And I think as an artist, it's kind of, you know, one of the things that Volksboutique allows me is to really decide where my interests lie in different fields and inform myself about them and get to try them on and practice them in a degree that is not necessarily faking them, but it's obviously not also apprenticing them to a degree. You know, many of the things I've kind of picked have been to, necessitated my having a PhD in them to execute them. And maybe I'm veering off from
it's okay.
the
It's a Joe Plummer thing.
Yeah. Exactly.
Redistribute the wealth. I think also what I find interesting, of course, is always also, like, let's say when one is working in the market in Bangkok, you know, selling T-shirt or something, it's not the same. I mean, you know, that's for me a kind of question, whether is it necessary for the audience or whoever it is that's come past through the thing to know that it is what it is, or is it what it is at all, you know, which is maybe art, right? And I think, it's not a question for me. I think on the one level, I think I'm quite interested to just get certain... Actually, it's almost like to just use the audience as a vehicle, in a way. But on some completely other level, there's a very different relationship and interaction for me in terms of, like, how close I can get. But not, I'm not actually, often I'm quite absent. So it's hard to say that I might be standing there cooking and making dinner for people. But then there are moments when I'm actually not there at all. And actually I'm always trying to avoid being in the middle of the situation.
Yeah, I think, you know, initially, I mean, it has always been very important for me to also, because I'm having this dialogue or perhaps monologue about what it is, what the work, what is work, you know, what work is expected of artists, or what work belongs into the artistic skill set. And so it was also very important for me to be seen working, so that people would see that, you know, like, I think you mentioned, it's like, you know, for some, you know, for people who maybe pursued something to not have to work, it can be quite, you know, laborious to be doing some of these projects. And I actually like to kind of feature that it's also not always very orderly, that it can be kind of chaotic or stressful or something. And in the attempts that I've had, if anything for kind of scheduling conflicts, that, you know, multiple things are happening and I can't be inhabiting a project, you know, five projects simultaneously, but that's also produced some sort of resistance, like that if a museum, for example, specifically is inviting a Folks Petite project, they kind of want it, you know, to be run by me. And that was an interesting dilemma to be in, that, you know, suddenly you're being faulted. You know, I kind of figure, well, if I design something, I design it how I expect it to run. And if it doesn't run centered around me, then it doesn't. But it's interesting how much kind of resistance there's been to that idea that, no, we want to see you work, you know. So
have you become a brand?
I hope not. I've intentionally kind of thrown up this other name, you know, that is intentionally nebulous about, you know, people call the studio and they'll say, you know, I'll say hello and they say, you know, could you find Christine Hill? We'd like to talk to her. And I'll be like, ciao, see what floor she's on. Hold on, you know. And it is, I like to actually play with the idea that it's, you know, the scale could be big. But I of course think I'm critiquing the notion of branding something more than embracing it, you know, and saying, yes, I am a brand.
I mean, you know, Christine was saying she didn't want to be a performer, you know, which is already the, I mean, and I completely understand that, because it's about, like, not wanting to be in the stage on, you know, under the light, you know. And I think the idea of just being another worker is much more, you know, I mean, appealing, I think, to both of us. You know, I'm just like the guy doing the work over there, you know, and you're not really sure, you know, whether that person's actually, you know, important or not. I mean, they're playing a role. But I think also that idea of the branding or the name or, you know, the author and things like that are like, I think, questions that, I mean, I have, you know, as a young artist. And I think, you know, trying to kind of find a way around that, you know.
But you find, you know, but is that really fair? Because at the end of the day, whether you are present or absent, you are the one who has created a situation. You have catalyzed some set of activity to take place. It didn't take place without you. So can you really slip away to the corner like that?
Well, I mean, you know, probably not, but that's why I'm still working, because I'm trying to slip away, you know. I mean, you know, because it's completely failed or something. But I think it's important to try to, for me anyway, to try to make the, at least people who've experienced the work, focus on themselves or on something else, which I think is probably maybe as important, you know. I mean, and not to always kind of depend, you know, on a kind of preconceived notion of what it is, or it's a recrit, you know, and I think there's going to be food there. You know, I've kind of like always tried to, you know, try
I'm hungry,
to
let's
get
see what he's
away.
Up to.
Yeah, you know, well, I'm starving myself for 3 days so because the guy's having an opening, you know. Like, you know, so they would arrive and there's no food, you know, because I know that they're starving themselves
and
for
you
3 days.
And,
you know, but that's the kind of, I mean, that's somehow been the kind of cat and mouse structure and I mean, you know, trying to deal with a certain audience that's very well informed about what you're doing, and they certainly have certain expectations of it. And I mean, because I think in a way, for me, there are a lot of other things else in the work than that, you know. And I hope that I could try to kind of put the audience into a position to recognize that.
Well, I think my shop at Documenta was in an underpass, which was, you know, prior to my tenancy there, a rather abandoned space. But it was, you had to go past it to get from, you know, exhibition space A to exhibition space B. And so people would come down there, and people were very concerned with kind of ducking in and saying, like, are you part of the, you know, like to determine, is this to be looked at or not to be looked at, or, you know, rather than just decide if it's interesting to them or not and go in, they would ask me if I was officially on board or not. But then when you got to the next passageway, there was a sock vendor, and he was a sock vendor. And so he had put up a sign, like, my shop had been a dry cleaner prior to me taking it over, and it had signage out the side that said the dry cleaning with the special service, and I had just replaced the dry cleaning with Volksboutique, with the special service. And so then he had all the signage up at his sock store that was like Volksstrümpfe, which were like the people's socks, you know, and suddenly, you know, it kind of, you know, gravitated over to him. And, you know, I kind of thought, hey, well, more power to, you know, and I thought it was interesting, because now all of a sudden all of these people were trying to position themselves according to, like, what is, you know, what's worthy of being considered now. Which, you know, I embraced.
You know, it's one of the things that I think is so interesting is that so much of what you both do is about creating sets of experiences between people who encounter each other in one of your events, or between yourself and someone who's involved in a project. And I wonder how, you know, we live in a kind of relentless material culture that always wants an artifact. It wants... It demands almost that there be something tangible. And obviously, Rickert, you found all sorts of ways of subverting that and critiquing it. But nonetheless, is the artifact that's left, the kitchen in which you cooked with its appliances, the experience of cooking that doesn't require a particular kitchen, but just the act of doing something together in the same way that collective farming in Chiang Mai doesn't require being in Chiang Mai. It requires a group of people simply deciding they want to farm together.
Yep. Yeah, sure.
It's so... It's
just go and cook.
Yes.
And don't worry.
Well, there are a lot of us who enjoy doing that.
No, I mean, I definitely think, you know, definitely that's, I mean, maybe the point it should get to is that people could then just continue to do it without having to have the recruit stuff there, you know, but actually continue to do it. So, yeah.
Let me turn to all of you and see if there are questions that you would like to ask. Yes, in the green shirt.
I'm just curious how you get payment.
How do I get paid?
Yes.
Swiss account. No, I mean, you know, actually, I mean, there's always kind of constant battle, at least, you know, at some level of thing, depending on the work. I mean, I'm not just making kitchens everywhere and... You know, I mean, there are other things I do, and they have their different reasons. And I'm working on a completely different thing now, you know, in terms of what I'm interested in. So I'm making a film or something like this. No, I get paid like everybody else, you know, like, you know, there's some little glass on the table and they actually buy it, kind of thing.
Rick Ritt was not the $4,000 artist, by the way. I thought I was vague about it because I didn't want to name names, but it wasn't. It wasn't Rick.
No, but I think, you know, you can't definitely you can't avoid that. You know, I definitely, you know, I'm not like trying to not have a living. You know, I'm trying to do as little but still have a living. You know, and I think like. if that little whatever that I do actually, you know, is actually something that is significant for people to kind of believe in, or you know, to try to even kind of understand it, and you know, that I think that's great. I think for me, it's always been quite important that the work is used. You know, I mean, I think that's something that I've kind of always pit up against, you know, the idea of, you know, being consumed, right? Once you're kind of consumed, you can be dead or you can be, you know, digested. But I'm trying to kind of keep it active, you know, even after that, you know. I mean, it doesn't always work, you know, but at least one is conscious of the problem, you know. Or at least I'm conscious of my problem, you know.
I have a question to Rickert. I wonder if you see your work or alternative economic structure as universal, because it, especially the land in Chiang Mai, is pretty much implicated with the locality. And at the same time, also alternative economic structure seems, is it really alternative or just going back to previous economic system like farming or agriculture, self-supportive economic structure? Okay, thanks.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think, no, I think alternative is I mean, maybe it's a kind of just rethinking, you know, and it could, I mean, I do things that are very normal and ordinary in life, and I think in a way, in a funny way, that you always have to constantly rethink that ordinary and normal things in life, because everyone's trying to do something else, or maybe, you know, or we're being fed the idea that we should be doing something else when we should just be doing normal, ordinary things, you know. And I think, like, in terms of, I mean, you know, rice farmers in Thailand, you know, 20 years ago never used fertilizer or pesticide, or, you know, or any orchards in Thailand. We always were organic. We just didn't know it, you know. And then today, you know, everybody's starting to go on this kind of whole organic and, you know, and natural way of growing. And everyone's been sold on all the chemicals. So they all have to, you know, suddenly stop and turn around and go back, you know. And but it's not that I'm trying to say one is better than the other or anything like that. I think, I mean, I think a couple of weeks ago I was reading to an audience in the new museum, you know, a book from this you know, he's not alternative, he's just a farmer, Japanese farmer, who decided that the best way to grow things was to not do anything to the plant, you know, to just let the plant grow, you know. And I mean, that's like just a different perspective on how one looks at, you know, your normal daily structure, you know. And I think maybe that's alternative, to like rethink your, you know, whatever you are in existing in.
Christine, how do you decide what labor you want to pursue? Is it just what interests you? Is there, you're so indexical in the way you collect and categorize information. Are you trying to create an index of production?
Good idea. I think I, yeah. I'm certainly interested in you know, I guess I feel like in, you know, when you get these epic forms to fill out and you fill and fill and fill and fill out and you wonder, like, you know, at the end, there, you know, in magazines there's always like, if you got scored between 1 and 35, you're this, and if you, and I wonder if I, you know, I don't even think I know that there's some sort of result or prediction or something at the end, but I'm, you know, filling in the cards. In terms of selection of roles, even though I don't like the word role, a lot of it is, you know, my tour guide office, I had a picture of myself with Conan O'Brien framed on the wall, like, you know, like pizza parlors always have, like, seems like Robert De Niro has probably been in every pizza parlor in New York City, and so there's a picture of him, you know, with the guys. And so I had this picture of myself and Conan O'Brien that I had elaborately arranged to have photographed in the wall. And, you know, and someone, one of my clients just said, wow, you know, you would be good at that. You know, and I thought, okay, I will try to be good at that. And so probably not without hitting it too heavy, I've taken on a lot of things that are either defined in part by being female, or in the case of a talk show host, maybe by not, you know, by not normally seeing a woman behind that desk. So that's occurred to me as well. Yeah, I am sort of incredibly occupied with, yeah, I just feel like there's a lot of things that can be investigated, and, you know, maybe, clearly a finite period of time in which I can investigate them. So I'm, you know, working through whatever occurs to me, or occurs to people to tell me to maybe take on. Isn't it like Tracy Ullman does that? Tracy takes on, and then she becomes someone else.
That was Sybil, who had multiple personalities, wasn't it?
But I don't like to see it that way.
Other questions? Well, yes, please.
pardon me. I'm curious as to how much your Christine's choice of projects are basically doing what you think people want to see or feel, and how much of it is driven internally by really what you would like to do.
It is interesting that it's almost parallel to kind of, you know, a musician makes an album and they make the album they've wanted to make forever, and then they make a second album and the album has expectations because there's a first album. And I think once you've made a name for yourself, then, you know, people expect you to show up somewhere and do that thing. And so you're, on the one hand, I feel also that, you know, Folks Boutique as an endeavor is a cumulative endeavor, and it's an additive endeavor, and one, you know, experiences that I'm having are informing the ensuing ones. But certainly I've had moments where it was absolutely never my intention to become someone who is predominantly doing art exhibitions in art spaces, and suddenly these opportunities were presenting themselves, and it was a very viable way of using those situations as clients. But I also realized that in the moment that something is being dictated to me rather than me saying I would like to do this, that's a dangerous moment, and it's certainly not the reason to become an artist in my case. And so I definitely am very concerned with not getting, making sure whatever's being assigned me is being assigned me by me. I have to actually, I'm sorry, Gene, I think I have to out you. The gentleman that just posed the question is the proprietor of my stationery store that I...
There's a question in the back. Yes.
I actually come from Thailand. Like, it's so hard to hear this in Thailand. I have to take train. I had to take a bus for 12 hours. So now I'm taking a plane for 18 hours to come here. Anyway, I just would like to know what both of you, what is the goal? Like, how do you move on? How do you see the goal of your work? How do you feel like it's done for this project and move on?
The goal?
The goal of your work.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah, to retire, you know.
Comfortably.
The goal, I don't, you know, yeah, to stop.
To see one's work sold for an extremely inflated amount at a Sotheby's auction, and one is not even participant in that event.
Yeah, what's the goal of your work?
You know, I actually, especially, you know, I live in Berlin, and it's very easy to live in Berlin and do nothing. And, you know, it's very cheap. You know, people have coffee for 4 hours. And so I think, you know, people have always kind of remarked that, You know, that there you know, there's a verb, or there's a verb phrase called Karriere machen, which means to make career, like to have a career. And this is obviously, you know, by most Berliners, kind of a disdainful thing. Like, oh, du machst Karriere, like you're having a career. And I think I somehow found myself kind of stamped as some sort of like goal-oriented, not a climber, but someone who, you know, and I just felt like I like activity. You know, I like to be in motion. I like to be active in doing things. I like to set up events that are active, and I've never really thought about trying to get anywhere with it. I think really, you know, in considering that 10-year anniversary sticker, I thought, wow, you know, who would have thought this would still be going on, or, you know, that there would still be, this would be generating enough interest to perpetuate itself. And to me, I mean, I think, you know, any small business owner is really just interested in perpetuation. And for me, what Volkspartei also affords me is that continuum without stagnation or without, you know, I had no intention of operating a secondhand store for eternity, but I managed to kind of just get around that problem by just calling everything this name, and then I can, you know, restructure it or reset it up the way I want.
It seems to me, actually, that you both deal quite specifically either with the subversion of the whole art practice or its critique. You rarely use the word art. You talk about a platform, which I assume is a platform either for you to create experiences or for other people to enjoy what they want to take out of that. In the same way that, you know, the Volksboutique can be read as dead on. You're not role playing. You're actually doing something that as well as you possibly can. But it can also be seen as a real commentary on the whole notion of exchange, production, and so on. And so that what ties, to get back to that question of goal, what seems to me that at the very least both of you are rethinking the nature of what an artistic practice is.
I teach a class at school which is called Skill Set, and it consists of inviting practitioners of all different vocations, bookbinders, stenographers, Japanese tea ceremony master, to the class, and the students have a very, you know, intense kind of apprenticeship with this person, and in the spaces in between these visits, they have to transform the space that the next workshop will happen in to accommodate that in a sort of ad hoc, you know, there's not a lot of money, so it's, you know, it's a lot of sort of solving the problem with ingenuity rather than, you know, throwing cash at it. But I really, you know, find that a really important tool for explaining to them that, you know, there's tons of available material, and that it doesn't always have to be about, you know, seeing art in a very narrow way.
Rickard?
Yeah, I agree.
Let's take one more question. Yes, up front.
I think this is a bit of an extension on the last question regarding goals. I was wondering if maybe both of you could say something about what's more or less personally rewarding in different iterations of your work. Like, how do you find some aspects of your work, some projects, more personally rewarding? Instead of using the word goal, maybe you could speak what is more successful to you in aspects of your work.
I think I was talking about like being able to operate in maybe like different parallel structures or layers of you know, interest in a way. And I think, I mean, you know, for me, it's they operate in completely different level, you know. I think if I could push the limits of, you know, the structure that I was in, let's say, you know, you know, Museum of Modern Art, that would be kind of fulfilling to me. Like that, I've kind of pushed them to the edge, and they've kind of let the children run around, you know, the sculpture garden with paint in their hand.
You all know that when Rickert was here, that and it actually was an utterly site-appropriate gesture, was to essentially recreate or evoke Philip Johnson's glass house, as I remember it. And then, of course, to do the one thing that Philip would never have had, which was to let everybody in. But I want to pick up on that question. How do you know? Do you judge your work? In other words, do you have a sense of when you've succeeded or when you've failed? Is that important to you to sort of look critically at what you've done?
I don't judge my
work. Why are you looking at me?
I don't judge anything. So, I think there is a kind of critical, kind of reflection on at least myself anyway. If and I think in what I do, I'm always kind of asking myself whether I've kind of compromised, you know, what I really wanted to get at, and you know, that's a small kind of question that I always kind of constantly ask myself. But I like this idea. We're constantly like moving and trying to shift things around and to do completely different something else. So you know, you kind of constantly have to reevaluate like what it is that you're getting at, you know.
Yeah, I was also going to say that rather than judge being the operative term, it would be evaluate and just sort of look at. And I actually think that, you know, either registering something that might have been an intent that didn't pan out or a mistake in the work is much more of a catalyst for moving something forward than evaluating something and being like, great job, that was great, you know, fantastic. And I don't think, you know, the work that I set up is usually, you know, prone to so much uncontrollable input from my part that it would be impossible for me to just smooth it out and say, yes, okay, that was perfect. And then, you know, it's also nice to get feedback from other people who will point out and say, I really like, you know, these aspects. A lot of these projects are happening over a prolonged period of time, so it's good to have someone else point it out to you and say this and this and this really, you know, was something I responded to.
Yeah, and I, you know, for me, I think with my work, it's really, I always felt that everybody has very different, come away from it with very different ideas about whatever it is. And that's for me, I you know, that's good for me. I don't really ever make anything that I expect people to come away thinking exactly the same, you know, from the other. So in that way, it's very hard to say I could judge it, you know, because it's not going to get to the same point for everybody. You know, and I think that's more important to me, that everyone walks away from it with very different ideas from the others, you know. But then, you know, like, what is that?
Christine, Rickert.
So if you had the impression that there was consensus being established, would that be then personally unsatisfying?
I think it depends. I mean, you know, on what it is, you know. But I would not be unsatisfied, but I would just say I don't really expect consensus, you know, like that it would all be good.
Are you indirectly asking us to tell you what would be satisfying to you? Because that is something we all have to figure out for ourselves.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
And thank you.